You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of July, 2012, on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Tyler Brulé. Coming up over the next 60 minutes, we'll get a read on the prospects for stability on the West Bank.
You're supposed to have an authority and a government and departments and everything that is supposed to be in a state, but the only thing missing is that there is no state.
And we'll also hear the reaction from Mohamed Morsi's handover ceremony following his election win in Egypt.
We want our home without any scaffolding. They have to go to defend the earth from the others, not from us.
And as Euro 2012 finally drew to a close, we discuss what lessons can be learned by the Ukraine. We'll also be joined by the author of ExxonMobil, an American power, to hear the fascinating story of one of the world's most powerful companies. And we're joined in the studio by industry book expert Benedict Page of The Bookseller to discuss the international business of books. All that, plus we'll be checking with Mario Garcia on the beach in Florida and consuming some very, very good stories as well, right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. But of course, as it's just the top of the hour here at Studio One, in Studio One at Midori House, it means it's time for the news, and it's over to James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. Mexico's former rulers have regained power following 12 years in opposition. However, the tight margin of their victory means they're likely to need alliances with other parties to push through reforms. Enrique Peña Nieto of the Institutional Revolutionary Party declared himself the winner of Sunday's presidential election and pledged that there would be no return to the past for Mexican politics. Four staff members from the International Criminal Court, held in Libya for 4 weeks, have been released. The announcement of their release came during a visit to Libya by the ICC President Sang Hyung-song. The team had been accused of spying during a visit to Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, son of the deposed Libyan leader, in the town of Zintan. Western powers have today agreed to stop overseeing Kosovo in September, 4 years after it proclaimed independence. However, NATO troops and EU police will continue to monitor the former Serbian province, still troubled by occasional ethnic violence. The 25-member international steering group, including the United States and major EU powers, said at a meeting in Vienna that Kosovo could now walk on its own feet without supervision. Its chief, the Dutch diplomat Peter Feit, explained the key aspects of what he described as a very important decision.
First, the group considered a proposal for ending supervised independence of Kosovo. Secondly, the group gave the green light to the government and the Assembly of Kosovo to adopt a package of constitutional and legislative amendments. And third, this is in anticipation of a final meeting of the International Steering Group in September in Pristina to terminate my mandate and close the ICO.
Three British soldiers have been shot and killed by an Afghan policeman at a checkpoint in Helmand province. It's understood that the shootings happened after an argument between the soldiers and a group of policemen. The gunman was also wounded and is now in custody. The new head of the World Bank has been speaking to reporters on his first day in the job. 52-year-old Jim Yong Kim, who was formerly president of Dartmouth College, takes over the post from Robert Zoellick. He said he was committed to boosting prosperity and growth in developing countries.
I'm very excited to get going, and I want to say to everyone here today that we will continue to do our work at the World Bank with innovation, with analytic rigor, and with great passion, working in partnership with governments, with civil society organizations, with the private sector, and most importantly, with the people living in poverty we aspire to serve.
Finland and the Netherlands have cast the first doubts on a European summit deal that's designed to save Spain and Italy from being engulfed by the Eurozone debt crisis. The Finnish government told Parliament that Helsinki and its Dutch allies would block the Eurozone's permanent bailout fund from buying bonds in secondary markets. And rare works of old master paintings, including works by Rembrandt and John Constable, are leading Christie's summer sale, which looks to become one of the most valuable in auction history. The sale, taking place on Tuesday, includes John Constable's The Lock, which is expected to fetch up to $40 million. According to John Stainton of Christie's, it's one of the British artist's most significant works.
It is the only remaining work in private hands from Constable's great early series of so-called six-footers, these large-scale pictures he painted of views on the River Stour. This is his native homeland. This is his father lived behind us, our viewpoint in the picture. That was Flatford Mill, which was owned by his father. And this is the only picture remaining in private hands from that series. Others include the Heywayne in the National Gallery, the White Horse in the Frick Collection. These are some of the world's great paintings.
And those are the main stories here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, James. It is just 5 minutes past midnight. If you're listening in Bangkok, it is 17:05 in Accra and it's 13:05 in New York. You are listening to Midori House. Back in a moment.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dobro pozhalovat, Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24
this. This is Monocle 24.
Afto en to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Well, it's half a year since the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas went to the United Nations with a bold bid for statehood recognition. The security situation, well, since then, the security situation in the West Bank has been deteriorating rapidly. Last month, the governor of the northern West Bank city of Jenin died of a heart attack after militants attacked his home in a hail of gunfire. Mahmoud Abbas responded with massive raids. The relative calm, which has become custom in the West Bank of late, might soon evaporate as the political and economic situation continues to worsen. Monocle's Joseph Dana reports from Jenin.
The geography of the North West Bank is unlike any other part of the territory. Dramatic mountains emanating from Jerusalem gently give way to rolling farmland. For the past several years, an uneasy peace has settled over these hills, known for the most vicious fighting that took place during the Second Intifada. But now that peace is showing signs of ending, after the governor of Jenin, Kadura Musa, died moments preceding a gun battle at his home.
For about 2 months since the death of Kadura Musa, the PA is taking several measures through which it is arresting tens from the area of Jenin for the suspected involvement in issues related to violations of law and order, as well as suspected role in the attack on the governor.
Ismail Talal Mukat recently took over the governor's office of Jenin after the sudden death of his predecessor.
This is what we are doing. There are a number of rumors that they are being spread in order to hamper our ability to protect law and order. If any objective institutions makes a survey on the street, it will find growing support of the PA and its latest measures it carried out in the Jenin governorate.
Fearful of challenges to its rule after the failed UN statehood bid and the attack on the governor's house, Palestinian Authority security forces were ordered by PA President Mahmoud Abbas to arrest over 100 people in Jenin and the neighboring city of Nablus in recent weeks. Officially, the PA maintains that these raids were designed to ensure that the chaotic security environment does not threaten the status quo in the West Bank. Jonathan Stanchek is the Swedish managing director of the Freedom Theater in Jenin. He has guided the theater's work of bringing art and culture to the people of Jenin since 2005. He gives his perspective on the changes taking place around him.
There is now, people are moving in the evenings, there's a vibrant cafe life, businesses have boomed. It is a schizophrenic situation where you are supposed to live in a reality where you're supposed to have an authority and a government and departments and everything that is supposed to be in a state, but the only thing missing is that there is no state, which makes everything virtual, very superficial and unstable. So the opinion of more and more people are that Palestinian Authority is actually a second kind of occupation because the Palestinians don't have a state, there is no continuity, there is no possibility for a vibrant a state to exist as things are now. So as long as that will not be resolved, the rest is just a joke. I feel that the cracks in the wall are getting bigger and bigger, and I believe that it won't last very long.
The Palestinian Authority is aggressively attempting to portray, in local media and abroad, the arrest as necessary to the maintenance of order. However, many residents dismiss the notion that there is a security crisis in Jenin. They argue, often vociferously, that there is no such problem and that the PA is merely afraid of losing its power. Abdallah Rahman Zabedi, the brother of Zakaria Zabedi, a famous militant of the Second Intifada turned artist connected with the Freedom Theater, who was arrested more than 2 months ago on suspected weapons charges, believes that Abbas is beginning to lose support of the Palestinian street. It is not clear why there are arrests. They say there is a chaotic security situation, but on the ground we don't see chaos. We don't see bodies on the street every day, or hear shooting every day. This is the problem they have invented, when they started saying there is a chaos. According to our expectations, the PA messed up on the political level, and they are afraid of the people. They have reached a stage where Israel is not giving them anything, so they resign themselves to oppress the people under the excuse that there is a security chaos. They have reached a dead end after 20 years of negotiations, because Israel has not given them anything. Abu Mazen has no program but negotiations, so he moved to exchanging letters with Netanyahu. There's nothing. People started complaining. Until when? The developing crisis of PA legitimacy in the West Bank is on the verge of being compounded by a fiscal one. Praised for his liberal economic policy by the West, PA Prime Minister Salam Fayyad is now facing a shortage of donor aid, especially from the Arab states, which may result in a shortage of salary payments over the summer. Sam Bahor, a prominent Palestinian-American businessman and political commentator based in Ramallah, explains that this is nothing new in Palestine.
The entire apparatus called the Palestinian Authority was created by donors to be able to have an ongoing fiscal crisis. They have never been in a position where they've been able to pay salaries comfortably. Mainly, the donors are able to keep the Palestinian Authority on a political string by always having them in a fiscal crisis. This round is no different. And basically, the prime minister is not the prime minister of a state with economic resources. The prime minister is the national fundraiser and has been so ever since taking office. So the Palestinian Authority is being forced into continually trying to fundraise for maintaining an inflated public service sector and no more.
Few people in Jenin wish to see an outbreak of violence with Israel. Yet they are increasingly frustrated at the inability of their political leaders to deliver real change on the ground. More and more, Palestinians are slowly realizing that in order to secure movement from Israel, the PA will have to be challenged over its failure to produce results so far. Yet, without an obvious unifying leader on the Palestinian political scene, it is likely that these tensions will continue to simmer as the situation becomes increasingly tense. Calm in this part of the world rarely lasts for long. For Monocle, in Jenin West Bank, I'm Joseph Dana.
And we'll be talking more about events in the region a little bit later with our Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor here on Midori House. Coming up next, though, we're heading not to the Ukraine. We'll be talking to someone from Chatham House, though, about lessons that can be learned from Europe 2012.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
And you are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It is just coming up to 14 minutes past 2 o'clock in the morning. If you're listening to us in Tokyo, 14 minutes past 6 o'clock here in London. Well, Euro 2012 is over, so it's time now to make some assessments and draw lessons from what we have witnessed with Ukraine co-hosting one of the world's largest sporting events. Joining us on the line is Yurisia Lutsevich, fellow at Chatham House, an expert on civil society development in Ukraine. Good evening.
Good evening.
I wanted to start out, there's so much talk at the moment, given that we're sitting in London, about legacy and of course, with all eyes on the Olympics. But let's focus on what it means for those sitting in Kiev, watchers of brand Ukraine. How do you think they're feeling about the afterglow at this point, Arisia?
Well, on average, people are quite satisfied, both political elites and average citizens, about the way Euro Cup took place. I mean, the country definitely received a large international spotlight and has become more known in Europe, because I think this is one of the fewest undiscovered spots in continental Europe. So what we have is very good country exposure. The Euro Cup went fluently. There were no major disasters, and I think at large it was success to bring a good, positive PR finally for a change for Ukraine.
Do you think that was, when you talk about the positive feeling, was it one which was, you know, immediately recognizable, do you think, in living rooms and in sports bars across Europe and around the world? Or is it more, let's say, the soft side, when the fans return to Sweden and they head back to Spain, they're going to tell a good story? So I wonder if you think it's really sort of immediate, or it's going to be a bit more of a trickle down.
I think it's both, because we already seen people from Sweden marching on Khreshchatyk saying, "Thank you, Ukraine." So, and the media exposure and the media coverage of Euro Cup in the German media and Swedish media and even in the UK media was positive about Ukraine. So I think, you know, the lag on tourism perhaps will take a bit longer. And, you know, people expect something like between 20% to 40% growth in the Euro Cup hosting cities, especially Lviv, which is a really something interesting to offer in terms of architecture and history. So the effect is already immediate. The media coverage is positive. Whether this will translate into people actually traveling and spending their money in Ukraine, time will show.
Mm. As you said, the effects may not be immediate in terms of what the economic benefits are in terms of, let's say, you know, the later inflow. What do you think the government in Kiev, you know, is really looking for if you sort of would project out across 18 months, 36 months, that also that there should be a stronger feeling for, you know, hotel development, that people, you know, that potentially want to look at, you know, manufacturing, you know, just might give it a punt and say, look, we're going to jump on the plane and we're going to fly to Kiev and see what the Ukraine has to offer?
Well, you know, I wish this would have a positive influence on investment climate, which is probably not going to happen, unfortunately, because with financial crisis and Ukraine's reputation of being a difficult place to do business, I don't think how this can immediately translate into some direct foreign investment opportunities. You know, I think this will have more slow scale, medium business, small business type of effect in tourism, in, you know, maybe in service industry. But Ukraine really has to put an act together to improve the investment climate at large, because it's not a good one.
Mm. I want to go back to, of course, there were a number of negatives that, you know, that certainly, you know, in the run up, you know, calls for, of course, you know, boycotts on the part of European leadership and other people, you know, heading to the Ukraine. Of course, many MPs and ministers scolded for going. Do you think, you know, now that, you know, Spain has packed up and gone home, Italy's, you know, heading back with their tail between their legs, do people remember, let's say, the downside of when all of this kicked off?
Well, I think people do remember that there are problems with democracy and with the opposition in Ukraine, and the Ukrainian opposition will try to make sure Western media remembers. How successful they will be, I don't know. But Ukraine is facing very crucial elections in October, where these are the elections where one of the major opposition leaders is in jail and cannot participate. So, you know, I don't think that the Euro Cup did magic to completely rip off the political climate that Ukraine is around. And, you know, the huge European Union attention to the upcoming elections will keep some focus on the political climate, and the Ukrainians who are trying to promote change will try to make sure that the world remembers about the outstanding problems.
Great. Arisia Lechevich, fellow at Chatham House here in London, of course, expert on civil society development in Ukraine. Thank you very much for that. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're back after this. Well, coming up a little later in the program, as I mentioned earlier, our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, will be here to, I'm sure he'll want to talk about football at that point. And also we'll be turning our attention to the Middle East. And in the meantime, though, of course, Mohamed Morsi has been sworn in as Egypt's first democratically elected president. After his oath, SCAF, the military council, which has controlled Egypt since the fall of Mubarak last year, handed over power to Morsi in a very elaborate military ceremony. But for many Egyptians, the army's continued influence in their country makes the president little more than a symbolic figure. Last month, as election ballots were being counted, SCAF issued a series of decrees essentially stripping the new president of much of his authority and affording itself legislative powers and a major role in writing Egypt's new constitution. Reporter Rebecca Collard talked to Egyptians in Cairo about their new leader and what they want next for their country.
Mohamed Morsi has been sworn in as Egypt's first democratically elected president. He took his official oath in front of Egypt's Supreme Constitutional Court on Saturday, praising both the revolution and the military, and promising Egyptians a better future. The new president should have taken his official oath in front of Egypt's parliament, but it was dissolved by the military last month. Following his swearing in, the military transferred power to Morsi in a grand but symbolic ceremony. While in recent years Hosni Mubarak had shed his military uniform for civilian garb, he too was an army man. Morsi will be the first civilian head of state. Since King Farouk was overthrown by a group of young military officers 60 years ago, Egypt has been led by military men. The day before he was sworn in by the court, Morsi took a symbolic oath in Tahrir Square, which was the epicenter of Egypt's uprising. Dozens of tents remain in the square, and a 50-meter-long banner reading, "We will stay until our demands are met," hangs above them. Standing under the banner, 26-year-old Fahma says SCAF should leave power immediately, now that Egypt has an elected president.
We just are here to protest. We didn't take our rights back yet. Because our president has nothing to do with anything. And the SCAF is not responsible for Egypt anymore. If we have a president, to give him his rights back and our rights back. We want our home without any SCAF in it. They have to go to defend the earth from the others, not from us.
For many here, the ceremonial transfer of power from the military to Morsi is not enough. In the last month, the military dissolved Egypt's recently elected parliament, and SCAF issued a series of decrees, essentially stripping the new president of much of his authority and affording itself new powers. Yahya Habib, a doctor who has manned a mobile clinic in Tahrir Square since last year, says he will stay until the civilian government is given its full authority.
I'm here to support our president, Mohamed Morsi, against the council, against the military council. We will stay here until we begin all the demands we want, until the parliament comes back. We need all the powers to be given to the president, not on a ceremony, but on the ground. We need it really, because he said to the human people, I will do 1, 2, 3 on a written program. To do that, he need budgets. The budget now is in the hand of the military, which will never give him the budget to do what he wants.
Yahya is confident if Morsi is given his full authority, the Muslim Brotherhood will be able to make the changes Egyptians need.
They have a written program developed over 80 years, written by more than 100 specialists in every specialty in economics and politics. They can do that, but they need full authority. President Mohamed Morsi needs full authority to do that.
But outside of Tahrir Square, Egyptians are focused on the country's stability. In his car part shop, Amr Shatta says that he voted for Ahmed Shafiq, Morsi's opponent, but says now the most important thing is not who leads the country, but the direction it's going in.
I don't care who has the power. I want development and stability. Everybody wants stability in this country.
Sitting in a street cafe a few blocks from Amr's shop, 75-year-old Mohammed Abu Hussein praises Morsi. Mohammed was born during King Farouk's reign and has spent the last 60 years ruled by a series of military leaders. This is his first day under a democratically elected president.
Under Mubarak, it was bad. There was no work, no money, and no freedom. I hope with Morsi this will change and the economic situation will get better, but we'll have to wait and see.
This balance between freedom and stability will be Morsi's biggest challenge. The country's new president will have to maintain the support of his conservative backers while negotiating with Egypt's powerful military and meeting the demands of his 85 million citizens. For Monocle in Cairo, I'm Rebecca Cotwood.
And you are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, 1826 here in London, 1326 in New York. And now to take us up to the arrival of James Luckhurst, who will be here in a few minutes with the news headlines. Here's a little something from our country fair. This is Afro Blue by Cecilia Stallion.
It's free to dance. You know, it's free to come forward.
Thank you.
And that was Cecilia Stalin performing for us live during the Monocle Country Fair. And she was performing Afro Blue here on Monocle 24. Coming up in the next half hour on this program, we'll be discussing international business books. And we'll also talk to the author of a new book, uncovering one of the world's most powerful companies. But first, a few headlines with Mr. James Luckhurst.
Mexico's former rulers have regained power following 12 years in opposition. However, the tight margin of their victory means they're likely to need alliances with other parties to push through reforms. Enrique Peña Nieto of the Institutional Revolutionary Party declared himself the winner of Sunday's presidential election and pledged that there would be no return to the past for Mexican politics. Four staff members from the International Criminal Court, held in Libya for 4 weeks, have been released. The announcement came during a visit to Libya by ICC President Sang Hyung-Song. Western powers have today agreed to stop overseeing Kosovo in September, 4 years after it proclaimed independence. However, NATO troops and EU police will continue to monitor the former Serbian province, still troubled by occasional ethnic violence. Three British soldiers have been shot and killed by an Afghan policeman at a checkpoint in Helmand province. It's understood the shootings happened after an argument between the soldiers and a group of policemen. The Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe has flown to Singapore for what a senior aide called a routine medical checkup. The visit has revived speculation about the health of the 88-year-old leader, who's denied reports he has cancer. The new head of the World Bank has been speaking to reporters on his first day in office. 52-year-old Jim Yong Kim, who was formerly president of Dartmouth College, takes over the post from Robert Zoellick. Finland and the Netherlands have cast the first doubts on a European summit deal that's designed to save Spain and Italy from being engulfed by the Eurozone's debt crisis. The Finnish government told Parliament that Helsinki and its Dutch allies would block the Eurozone's permanent bailout fund from buying bonds in secondary markets. Those are the main stories here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Mr. Luckhurst. 13:32, if you're listening to us in New York, 10:32 in Vancouver. Now, every once in a while, in fact, every day, we try to bring an editor down from the editorial floor. Usually we're successful. And today we found our very own foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
Now,
I said
after the off the back of the piece we were doing on Euro 2012 that you'd probably want to talk a little bit about that. I'm wondering, is this almost a public stimulus package, do you think, for Spain?
For Spain, absolutely. It's if anything can help boost morale, then the style of the victory and obviously the victory itself really helps. Whether that does much to the economy, well, probably not. But at least what it does do is it shows Spain in a very positive light on the international stage, and that is no bad thing.
And that they know how to manage a very complicated sport.
Well, indeed. And also that they're united as a country. Lots of Catalans in the team, as well as people from elsewhere, including Madrid. So the fact that they all come together as one, a good thing for national unity in Spain.
Why don't we make our way towards Syria? But before that, let's just stop in Kiev. When I was talking to Rysia earlier from Chatham House, she thinks that the afterglow is actually quite good for the Ukraine, despite all of the hiccups. We didn't really touch on the whole racism issue in it, but certainly for a country which has some rather sort of questionable areas when it comes to democracy. How do you think they fared?
When they got the tournament a few years ago, they would have hoped it would have gone a lot better than this. Certainly, they would have thought this was their coming out party as an independent nation, as a strong European nation. But if you'd asked them 4 weeks ago, just before it started, when there was the problems they're having with the jailing of Yulia Tymoshenko, with the very public stories about racism. If you'd asked them then to take what they've got in the end, they would have been very, very happy, because it hasn't actually been that bad for them. It's shown Ukraine in a decent light. A lot of things did go well. The stadiums look very good. The fans on the whole actually have been very good. All the incidents of racism actually during the tournament were from other countries. So in that sense, they should be fairly pleased with how it's gone.
Let's go to Syria. Obviously, we saw what could have been another significant flare up with Turkey over the weekend. Turkish jets scrambled as Syrian helicopters came very close to the border. They didn't cross into Turkish airspace. What happens this week? I mean, as summer temperatures rise, do you think the same thing happens diplomatically as well?
I think neither Turkey or Syria, certainly at the top level, neither of them actually want this to develop any further. Syria, because they've got their own internal problems that they are having enough trouble dealing with at the moment to try and start a war with a neighbour. And Turkey, because frankly, they don't really need this. Mm. Erdogan might like to wave a big stick and say things that maybe sort of get everyone a little bit hot under the collar. But when it comes down to it, they don't want there to actually be a war. They're incredibly concerned about what happens in Syria. They've got a 550-mile border with Syria. They're already, some sort of military build-up on that border in preparation for what may happen. They really don't want to stir it up. And it was interesting, when I was in Brussels last week talking to Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the NATO Secretary General, he was very much of the view that, well, yes, Turkey as a member of NATO has raised this with us. We are going to look into it. We're going to write a stern letter. Mm. But none of us want this to turn into anything more serious than it already is.
Steve Bloomfield, you have to scamper back upstairs because you've got Monocle Mediterranean to get out as
I
well,
do.
Don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
As do I.
Well, yeah. You still need to write an essay.
I know. I'll see you in about 24 minutes. You're listening to Midori House. Up next, we're going to be talking to the author of Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. Stay with us.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
And you're back with Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé, here on Monocle 24. ExxonMobil is a global entity unto itself. It has a revenue which is equivalent to the GDP of Norway, yet despite being the world's most powerful company, it is also known as one of the most secretive. Steve Cole, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, investigates ExxonMobil, revealing the chilling extent of its power base and how it carries out its activities in his new book, Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. And he joins us on the line from New York. Hello, Mr. Cole.
Hey, Tyler, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. I wanted to start. You're, of course, quite famous so far for your book on the Bin Ladens, and with so many roads leading back to Saudi Arabia. Was that the starting point for this?
It was, yeah. I came out of that book about modernization in Saudi Arabia and thought I really should try to write something about oil, especially in the age of limits and argument and American power. So much of America's place in the world seems driven by oil, and trying to get underneath the surface of that seemed like a good project. ExxonMobil really is American oil policy. They're the largest corporation headquartered in the United States and a very closed institution that doesn't receive much scrutiny. So that was my motivation.
Mm. And you talk about American oil policy, which I guess equates to American foreign policy on many levels.
Well, it does, and it was a question of exactly how. What does that mean? And it was surprising in some ways. I mean, for example, I was surprised to discover that 25% of ExxonMobil's oil production today comes from West Africa, because they've been driven out of the Middle East through nationalism there into weaker states. And so they end up in these very unstable, very poor societies where, the United States as a government isn't much present, but ExxonMobil on the ground in some of these countries is just enormously powerful.
Mm. When you look at their power base, on the African continent, are you looking at ExxonMobil alone and in isolation? Because, of course, they've got some very big and muscular competitors from this island of the UK and also from France and elsewhere. So is ExxonMobil sort of really sort of, the figurehead, but, everyone else is pretty much, behaving the same way? Or what is unique about the ExxonMobil construct?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, there's sort of five or six of the big super majors tethered to industrialized democracies, France, Britain, the United States. ExxonMobil is distinct because it really lives in defiance of its own government in a way that Shell never would or Total never would in France. It's a Texas-headquartered company that was forcibly broken up by a court order at the beginning of the 20th century, and their chief executive today says his favorite book is Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, which is this dystopian sort of novel about suspicion of government and and concentrated power, of which, of course, ExxonMobil is a pretty good representative. But it's kind of only in America would we have a national oil company that would live in disdain and distance from its own government. And so they really operate independently from the U.S. embassy in many of these places. You know, in France, you have a much closer ties between the national oil company and the government.
Mm. As, of course, you know, one of the most important you know, companies, certainly when you look at revenue levels, I mean, globally, do you think they almost operate as a model for others to follow? And when I mean others, when we look at the rise of course, you know, Asian economies, and you know, whether we look at Chinese oil companies, Japanese oil companies, the Koreans as well, you know, is there something where you would almost think that there would you know, those companies, would they be more in lockstep with Beijing or Tokyo or Seoul, and it is, you know, or potentially is ExxonMobil, you know, still an entity unto itself?
Well, they're very independent and they're very distinctive. Their strengths are that they are incredibly disciplined, tight, and effective at operating, bringing projects in on time, worker safety, just corporate and financial discipline is probably the gold standard on the world stage right now. The Chinese and the Koreans are certainly trying to push in that direction, but ExxonMobil's competitive advantage is that they can, you know, advertise a record of technological and financial performance that no one else, except, you know, maybe Shell and few other Western companies can compete with. They, you know, their ability to keep that edge is interesting because it drives them more and more into risky environments. They drill in deeper and deeper water. They drill north of the Arctic Circle in very hostile environments. They have to in order to have something to say about the competition with the Chinese and the Asian companies that come with their government support, you know, weapons packages, soft loans, a UN Security Council veto. So it's one of the paradoxes of the subject is that they're an enormously powerful corporation in the context of the United States. Their influence in Washington is outsized. They have lobbying operations all around the world. But in a global context, it's ruthless competition that they face.
Hmm. I want to go beyond obviously, exploration in West Africa. Where else are they the hot spots for them right now? And you, of course, you know, you mentioned drilling it at the top of the world, and a great race going on there. Do you explore, of course, you know, the Great Open Road and where this company ends up next?
Yeah, so they're distributed all around the world. I think they operate in more than 150 countries, but in real drilling, they're, you know, in five or six dozen places. Russia is an important venue for them these days. They just cut a huge deal to drill north of the Arctic there. They're big in Canada, in the oil sands. And where they go next is they have a high degree of confidence that oil and gas are unbeatable for the next 40 or 50 years. If they're shifting a little bit from oil to gas, because gas is easier to acquire in the United States and other free market countries, they don't have to put up with the civil unrest in the Niger Delta that they have to deal with in the global oil economy. So they're shifting towards gas, but they basically have this highly confident five, six-decade belief that alternative energy does not threaten them and that oil and gas is here to stay.
Mm. Steve, just before we go, does a company like ExxonMobil remain a U.S. company? You know, we often hear the likes of, you know, HSBC saying they want to, you know, pull everybody, you know, out of London, et cetera. If you know, if a company like that doesn't get its way, is it important for Washington to hold on to them, or could you see them, you know, upping sticks and saying, you know, we're moving to Singapore?
I think they're already not so much of a U.S. company, really. And you see that with all of these large banking and energy companies in the post-Cold War world. They become untethered from their national systems. They don't really have a subordinate loyalty to the United States. Culturally, yes, in terms of their historical inheritance and the values they bring to the world. But in terms of their business, ruthless business decisions and the way they see their own interests, no. They already, I don't think, see themselves much as an American company. They're headquartered there, but they could easily be headquartered someplace else.
Steve Cole, thanks very much. That was Steve Cole, author of Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Well, coming up next, we're going to be joined in the studio by Benedict Page, who is the news editor at The Booksellers, to discuss the international, the international business of books. But before that, here's a little something that I picked up on my tours. This is Waiting by La Ong Fong from Thailand. And that was Waiting by La Ong Fong from the studios of Bangkok. And that's from the 2011 album, Wind Up City. It's just 1847, almost 1848 here in London. Well, today we start a new weekly feature here on Midori House, the business of books. In fact, well, of course, we were just talking to Mr. Cole about his new ExxonMobil book. And after this, we're going to be heading off to Florida to talk to magazines with Mr. Mario Garcia. But before that, to kick things off, I am joined by Benedict Page, news editor at booksellers.com. Welcome.
Hello, thank you.
Where should we start? Should we start right on bookshelves and see what's flying off shelves at the moment? Should we head to printing presses? Where should we go?
I think we should start with book that's flying off the shelves, because it's the thing we're all talking about in the book industry all over the world at the moment. And that is the phenomenal success of the racy bestseller 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Now, this is a book that started off life as fan fiction for Twilight fans. It took a little segue into ebooks, and then it really started to take off, first in Australia, then in the US. Now it's a huge record breaker in the UK, both in print and digital editions. It's a huge seller apparently in India. It's selling very well in Singapore. Everyone's going crazy for it.
Mm. I just, you know, on that, the excitement is because how it, as you said, it sort of, you know, it was a slightly different trajectory in terms of, you know, how it gained popularity, or?
I don't think so. I think that's really quite incidental to it. I think every now and then there is a slightly racy book that takes off. And what's different now is because of ebooks, everything, and because of Twitter and Facebook, everything moves so quickly across the globe. And what's different now is that traditional book publishers are having to move very, very swiftly to catch the wave as it goes digitally around the globe. Because, for example, in the UK, the ebook was already available because you know, it had been prior published in the US and in Australia. So print publishers, Random House in this case, moved very, very quickly to get their print copy out and catch the wave. And it really has broken all sales records. Last week, the sales figures that were announced were for the three books of the trilogy in the UK, 855,000, which is phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. And basically, in its first few weeks of life in the UK, the first book in the trilogy has sold more than the best-selling paperback of the whole of last year, which was David Nicholson's One Day. So that's quite an achievement.
Right. So hence the smile on your face is that people are still reading. Doesn't matter whether they're reading digitally, whether it's off of good old paper. That's really sort of, you know, the essence of the excitement.
Yes, and we think a lot of people who don't read regularly are reading this book.
And also, do you think that this, you know, oftentimes we've been talking to agents and various publishers as well, and people have been, you know, have been saying, you know, they're at Frankfurt, they're at the book fair in London, and everyone's been looking for that next genre as well.
Yes.
Excitement as well, because, okay, then we're now into a whole autumn of other you know, erotic type of...
I'm afraid they're surely going to follow, yes.
let's stay in the UK. Now, I was mentioning things at digital. You're saying maybe something, well, depends how you look at it, but something quite unfortunate might be happening with the Cambridge Press.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily unfortunate. I think it's a sign of the times. And again, it's the sign of how technology is transforming the industry for academic publishing as for every other form. Cambridge University Press has had its own in-house printing press for 400 years. Massive historical feature of the publishing house. It has now said that it's proposing to close that down and make use of, you know, an external one, one that's already invested very heavily in digital technology. Because essentially, a company like CUP is known all over the world. It sells all over the world. And it makes much more sense with technology as it is to send digital files and print locally in each of the countries. So if it's a wonderful tradition gone from CUP, which I guess, you know, one has to have a sense that is the case. It's the start of, you know, lots of printing in the various countries around the world served that CUP serves. So it's really a sign of the times, I think you have
Better
to say.
You sound like a management consultant from one of those, like, you know, major multinationals that goes in and just says, okay, well, you know, you shouldn't be running your own business, outsource
You know, I'm sure if I worked at Cambridge University Press, certainly I worked in the printing press. If I had a bit more personal knowledge of that, I would be very, very sad. But, you know, we at the bookseller do have to look at it a bit as an industry. And it's an overwhelming pressure. The chief executive at CUP told me that they'd seen 70% growth in their digital take up over the last year. So 70% growth in the sales of the things that they produce digitally in the last year. Now, if that happens, what are you going to do? You know, the whole industry is changing. And we have to move with the times, much as we may lament on one level.
I'm going to see if they're selling it off. Maybe there are opportunities there. Of course, the season of filling up one's travel bag with books is upon us. I wonder what's happening on the high street here. Where are we with Waterstones? You know, much discussion, of course, when Mr. Daunt went there.
Yes.
Recent deal, of course, with Amazon.
Yes.
As well. How you know? And of course, we start to move. You know, very quickly. You know, we'll be out of the summer season, heading towards Christmas. What's your prognosis for the state of the high street in this country, at least?
Well, this week, in fact, is Independent Booksellers Week in this country, and there's going to be, you know, a huge amount of activity. There is a huge amount of activity around that. And we are seeing, you know, independent booksellers really, you know, digging in and making an event out of what they do. You know, Foyles, the legendary bookshop on Charing Cross Road, has been, Foyles and Blackwell's, both on Charing Cross Road, have been having a festival. They had a wonderful day. Love Charing Cross Road Festival. You know, they've been very inventive.
Well, love Charing Cross, despite all of that awful crossroad construction. But anyway.
Yes. And, you know, Waterstones, well, you know, everybody wants Waterstones to succeed. Everybody in the industry wants Waterstones to do really, really well in the months leading up to Christmas, the biggest months of the book selling year. So we've all got our fingers crossed that James Daunt's you know, new style, as it gets into its second Christmas, is going to proceed well.
Excellent. Benedict Page, news editor at booksellers.com. Thanks very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. We're back in a moment. Well, as I was saying just a little bit earlier when I was talking to Benedict, of course, it is the season of gathering your reading material to read on a lounger. Of course, it might be in paper form, it might be in digital form. And I thought we should talk about newspapers and magazines. And there's only one gentleman to talk to, and I think we're interrupting him on a beach somewhere in Florida. Newspaper and magazine design guru, Mario Garcia, and of course, a regular here on Monocle 24. Are you there, Mario?
I am here. Hi, Tyler. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm enjoying Longboat Key, Florida. It's hot and it's nice, and 10 days of this is what I needed after a busy year.
Excellent. Listen, we're at the half-year point, and as people are heading to, they're heading poolside, they're heading to beaches, at least across the Northern Hemisphere right now. How are people consuming media? And also, what's in Mario's tote bag of reading material this summer?
Well, I have Monocle, of course. I have just almost completed the last edition, and I was reading it right at the beach after my run early in the morning. It's surprising to see the number of people here in Florida, people of all ages, who are reading books and newspapers and magazines. I've seen a lot of Vanity Fairs out there. I've seen a lot of The Economist out there because I run. So I go up and down 4 or 5 miles, and obviously you do see your Kindles, and you see your iPads as well. But also, a lot of the people using these iPads are taking pictures or making a movie. Print is still very much along the coast of each part of the Gulf of Mexico. You still see a lot of people reading in print, for sure.
Excellent. Now, when you managed to get yourself off that beach, Mary, what are the big projects that you have coming up? And, you know, obviously, you know, as you said, you're running up and down the beach, sort of analyzing how people are consuming media. I'm sure lots of big media owners are going to be doing the same. So what's going to be keeping you occupied from at least midway through August onwards?
Well, a lot of interesting projects, and it's a variety of print and tablet. And in many cases, most of what I'm doing right now is taking care of what I call the media quartet. I mean, a modern, if someone calls you and all they want to do is basically take a look at the newspaper and change the font, I had a conversation with them. I said, you know, maybe that is not what you should be so concerned about. You should be concerned about how people right now consume news, and it's across four platforms. And print will always be there, and it will be one of the platforms. But, for example, I'm very excited, and I cannot openly talk about some of these projects, about newspapers being born. Can you imagine, Tyler, that I am involved with the birth of two newspapers in two different parts of the world that I cannot mention yet? But these newspapers begin as print products. The other platforms are going to be there. But when you get the call, in both cases, someone would say, I would like to start a newspaper. One of them would be a Sunday-only newspaper. There is a great deal of enthusiasm in the industry towards the weekend newspaper. And there is a lot of evidence that Monday to Friday, maybe people have less time to read in print. But again, and you are one of the pioneers in talking about this, the luxury of paper, the power of disconnect, the weekend printed newspaper is going to become more robust. Sunday newspapers in the U.S., I've done work with the Washington Post this year, and we've really done a lot of rethinking of their Sunday edition. So there is a lot of enthusiasm, but in 2012, there are newspapers being born, and that is something to celebrate. Along the way, then you do their mobile edition and you do their tablet, but it's incredible that still the newspaper is the mother's milk of it all, basically.
Mario Garcia, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much for that. When we're off air, you can tell me about where in the world those are going to happen. That is all for this edition of Midori House here on Monocle 24. Today's show was produced by Don Trump, was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. News is up in 1 minute. Thanks very much.